This is exactly right.
If you're a fan of meticulously crafted worlds that reimagine every little detail, then you'll enjoy the podcast Imaginary Worlds.
Host Eric Molinsky spent over a decade working in public radio and uses those skills to create a sound-rich podcast that features interviews with Andy Weir, who wrote The Martian, the writers of hit TV shows like Star Trek Strange New Worlds, designers of games like Magic the Gathering, and the puppeteer who designed Miss Piggy.
You can find Imaginary Worlds wherever you're listening to this podcast. Everybody, welcome to another episode of I Saw What You Did. My name is Millie DeCherico.
I'm Commodore Danielle Henderson.
Commodore.
I feel like we should be able to pick our own prefixes.
Yeah.
Like Ms. isn't doing it for me. I don't know. Like Ms. Danielle Henderson. I want to be fucking Commodore. I want something that indicates the what's about to happen with you if you meet me.
You know, you're right about this, because I will say, you know, I was on my little European vacation a couple weeks ago, and for every form, like, okay, this happens in the U.S. too, I get it, where, like, you know, you fill out a form, and they're always asking you to pick, like, a Mr., Ms., 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 Mrs., Doctor, whatever. Like, they ask you to pick, like, a prefix, right? And it's usually pretty optional, I think, in America. I feel like in Europe, it's like a standard thing. They like really want to know.
Every form.
And I was like, why? Just you want to know if I'm married or something or what?
You trying to get in up in this?
Yeah.
I'm just trying to go to the bathroom, sir. Like, why do you have to know my fucking prefixes?
Well, let me ask you this. Maybe you know this and I don't. Is there a difference between MS period and MISS?
MISS is supposed to indicate a younger woman. MS Ooh. Is like a fucking spinster, thornback, older woman.
I do not like that shit.
I don't like it at all.
Yeah.
I'm fucking Commodore. And no, I've never been on the seas, and I've never commandeered a fucking ship, but I'm a fucking Commodore, okay?
Look, didn't that, what's his name from Scientology? What's his,
Oh, yeah, L. Ron Hubbard.
Didn't he call himself a Commodore?
He called himself all kinds of shit.
Yeah. So all you gotta do is buy a boat, and I guess you can be a Commodore, right? That's kind of
his. Here's the thing. I don't even have to do that, because how do you know I don't own a boat, whoever I'm talking to? You don't know?
Yeah.
I'm Commodore, and you just assume I own a boat, and that's on you.
Yeah. I'm with it. If you want me to start calling you, what is the abbreviation for Commodore? Isn't it like CMMM or something?
CMD, I think. No, that's Commander. I guess I should really, if I'm really going to go with this ruse, I got to figure that shit out. What's the abbreviation? Or I could say, don't ever abbreviate it, because that is not treating it with the respect it deserves.
Yeah. Well, now I'm going to have to go on the internet and Google, like, what we have to do in your presence now that you're a Commodore. Because, you know, like, sometimes you get a salute, sometimes it's like a whole thing. And so I want to be proper about it. So
I'm going to make something up. I'm going to be like, you have to do a dance to back that ass up. And it has to be at least 60 seconds long. Like a choreographed dance to back that ass up.
Look, I'll do anything for you, as everybody knows.
If I'm making it up, I'm really making it up. But I think, also, I live in this tiny place, so nobody is ever going to question it. They're going to be like, whatever. We don't care what you call yourself. Do you want a small town update?
Well, I was going to say, what's going on? What's going on in that small town?
Let me give you a small town update. I haven't given you one in a while. Mm-hmm. Two cute things, because again, my town is basically Stars Hollow. There's a neighbor that lives up the street who I've met. It's a man and a woman who are a couple, and I've met them pretty much as soon as I moved in, because they walk their dog a lot. They have a very cute dog with human eyes, which I love. I love when dogs have, like, human eyes, and you're like, oh, you have been here before. and their dog is super cute. When I first moved in, they saw me walking the dog, and they were like, oh, we don't know if you saw this yet or not, but there's a box around by the barn. And it's going to rain and it might get wet. And, like, we just didn't know if you saw it. So we just kind of started just chatting, like whenever I see them, if I'm driving by and they're walking the dog and I wave. And they put a note in my mailbox and it was like, hey, it's us from up the street. You should come over for coffee one day or wine. Like, it would be great to sit down and have like a real talk.
What?
And I'm like, that's adorable. So yes. I went to their mailbox and I left a note that was like, yeah, that sounds great. Here's my name and number, or here's my number, email, text, whatever. But let's definitely get together soon. So that's how you do it in these backwoods towns sometimes. You just leave a note in a mailbox.
Listen, I think the next move, well, it's their move, right? They would have to send you a strippergram. That's like the next the next step in the point of the back and forth contact. And then you send them a strippergram.
And this, the first strippergram to me is just someone like reading off a date and time. Like, why am I taking my clothes off for this? They want you to hang out on Wednesday night at 7 p.m. Why am I naked for this?
Our telegrams, that seems like such a fucking old thing that doesn't happen anymore. But it has to happen still, right? No?
I know that like Western Union still happens, but I don't know if straight up telegrams, like this is the only way you're going to get this information, happens. But it would be kind of cool. See, this is where, like, if I were a criminal mastermind, I would go back to telegrams because nobody's checking telegrams anymore.
Yeah. Well, and it's mostly the performance of the message, which I think is lost.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like there was like an entire industry based on people who were performing messages for other people, like gorillas, like strippers, like people who were just regular male people.
Yeah.
Would read out to, but that seems like a profession that's died off.
Yeah, it was like a way that a lot of actors used to make money. Cause they were like, well, I'm still kind of acting and I'm getting paid.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's dead.
Well, and that's the thing too. Your town, I think, would be so suited for that kind of thing. Like, because honestly, like in Atlanta, nobody's doing a, no one is going to perform a message that we're too hardened. We're too distrusting.
Yeah.
Like that's a huge thing. Cause you're basically like, somebody arrives on your doorstep in any kind of costume, already you're like, am I going to just speak to them through the ring? Like, I don't want to face them because what if they're a murderer? Because costume, like surprise costumes are weird. So that would never, like that kind of stuff would never happen. But I feel like in your town, because it's so, you know, cute and Stars Hollow-ish.
Yeah.
You could do singing telegrams and stuff.
I might bring it back. I mean, it would definitely work. Like another neighbor story recently is that my only next door neighbor, I have one single neighbor who lives next door, and they are a retired couple. And the woman called me one day. She called me on a Saturday and was like, hey, I'm at my grandson's basketball game. Are you home? And I was like, oh, I'm just finishing up lunch with my grandma, but I'll be home in like 20 minutes. What's up? She's like, I was making wontons and I think I left the boil, like the pan on. Could you just like run in and check and make sure that it's like unplugged? And I was like, yeah, no problem. Is there a key? She's like, oh no, the door's open. I'm like, what? Like, what?
Dude,
and it
was.
I just walked right into their fucking house and it was totally unplugged. Like, I'm like, yeah, I'll check and make sure your house doesn't burn down. But like, if I ever forget anything in my house, you cannot get in without the cops coming because I have alarms everywhere.
I literally can't imagine that.
I know. It blew my mind. I'm like, again, they've lived here for like 50 years, small town. Yeah. And even when I bought the house, the woman I bought the house from was like, oh yeah, I only have one key and I had to really find it because I never locked the doors. And I'm like, how are people living like, I don't know. I'm bringing a different energy. But for that reason, I think strippergrams would be fine here. Or any kind of telegram would be fine here because people are happy to open a door or leave a door open for you.
Well, and like, I gotta be honest, man. I would love that. Like, it's exhausting to be this vigilant. Like, listen, I'm that type of person. And this is probably less related to the violence of the major American city that I live in. And it's more about my own bullshit. Right. Like it's OCD paranoia shit. But like, I try to take all my groceries in one go.
Absolutely.
Because if I don't, then I'm locking the car.
Exactly.
And then bringing in, because I can't even that like 5 minute thing of like taking one round of groceries inside the house, I don't trust people in that 5 minutes to Absolutely. Not break into my car and steal it. Like, that's how terrible, like, the situation is in my brain.
Absolutely. Meanwhile, in my town, people are like, it's cold, I'm going to warm up the car, and they leave it running with the keys in it.
Yes, which, you know, as we've seen in so many 70s movies, that is such a fucking one-way ticket for somebody to steal your car, is that when Absolutely. You just leave the keys in the car? Yes.
Or even at Dunkin' Donuts. I'll pull up at Dunkin' Donuts. I can't tell you how many times a car next to me is just running and the person is inside getting coffee. I feel like I'm inviting people to come here and start crime. Please don't. Like, no. Don't come to my small town and start doing crimes. It's just weird to me that, like, and this is also how I grew up. We never locked our front door. I never had a key to my house when I lived here.
Yeah.
As a child. We never locked the doors here.
Yeah.
So a lot of people just don't. A lot of people just don't. And I'm like, I lived in too many cities. I've been out in this world for too long. Yeah. I am not. If I left a pan of wontons frying, my house might just have to go up because you cannot get in.
Well, and the craziest thing is that theoretically, it's like she doesn't even know you. Like, theoretically, she doesn't even know you. So the fact that she's just like, let me just call up somebody I barely know and have them walk into my open house. That's fucking trust, dude. Like, that seems so chill and relaxing. I would love.
And it's only, it's really chill. And it's only from like driveway conversation. Like, we talk. Like, she knows me enough. Like, they know what I do. And like, they kind of like are like, hey, how's it going? How's TV stuff? How's, like, we talk in the driveway all the time. But, you know, and I called them a couple of weeks ago. I called and I was like, hey, the town switched our recycling program and we have a new bucket from like a new company that's picking up the recycling, and they just haven't picked up the old one for like a month and a half. So I called them and I'm like, hey, I finally just called, you know, that old recycling place, and they said they're coming to pick them up on the 28th. So put them out on the 28th, and they're like, cool, we're going to be visiting grandkids. And I'm like, oh, well, I'll just, you know, just leave your bucket out. I'll come get it and I'll put it on the car. Like, we're neighbors in that way. But yeah, like, she doesn't know me. I'd be throwing a party in there right now. They have a pool. It's a sick house.
See, I wish I only have like I have a neighbor who is kind of my like make sure I don't get robbed neighbor. And I do the same for her, even though she has been robbed. She just recently was robbed.
You fell down on the job.
I was. And it was that crazy thing where she came over and she was like, yeah, somebody broke into the house. They climbed through one of the back windows. Did you hear anything? I'm like, no. Of course, I didn't hear anything. You know,
oh my God.
But it was that thing of like, I felt terrible for her because we've been doing this for each other. But I was like, yo, like, sometimes people are slick, man. And they do it and no one knows anything. But I felt bad because like now I was gone, you know, for like a couple weeks, you know, a few weeks ago. And she was really sweet because, okay, here's the thing that annoys the shit out of me about where I live. So I think I'm like in this like one, I'm in this like area of town where I'm like in an unincorporated area. I think that's what they call it, where you don't pay like the tax for the city that you live in, but then you also don't get your mail sometimes.
Right.
Right. And so every time I go out of town, I put a hold on my mail.
Right.
And every single time they still deliver it. Every fucking day. And it just piles and piles into the fucking mailbox, and it's spilling out. And it's just a message.
Like, here's a number one, like the number one way people know I'm not here.
Yes. It's like yes. It just telegraphs like, by the way, this person hasn't been home for like 3 weeks.
Oh,
please come rifle through my old lady things. But like, so the problem is, and I literally tried every single way to have them hold it. Like, I do it through the USPS. I had them deliver it on the last day that I was going to be gone. That never happened. I had them hold them at the post office for me to come pick up. That never happened. So I don't know why this post office or whatever. I don't even know where my local post office is, to be honest. So my kind neighbor has been literally checking my mail every day and like hiding it, you know, because they will not hold my mail even though I asked them to. And it's just sad because I'm just like, I would love to like live in a place where I can just, I mean, shit, I could leave for 3 weeks and my door's just open. My neighbor's just like, yo, let me put your mail in your house. Check your plants, do whatever, you know?
Absolutely. I have a cat sitter when I leave, like a cat sitter slash house sitter who comes and stays. But it's so, it is really nice to just be like, and I actually, I found my cat sitter through a friend of mine who lives up the street, who I went to high school with, and she has two dogs. And so the first time I was leaving, I'm like, hey, I'm leaving. I don't know what to do. I can't count on my fucking family. And she gave me this person's name, but she only gave me her first name. So this time, this last time I took a vacation and I left, I was like, just curious, what's our pet sitter's last name? Like, just in case I have to call in a crime or something. And she was like, oh. And then she told me the last name, and she's like, I never even thought about that. And I'm like, yeah, this person is like living at my house and I don't even know their last name. Yeah. So I fixed that. But yeah, and she's really sweet. She's like just so sweet, and she likes animals more than people. And that's exactly who you want staying at your house. And I went away for a couple of days once, and she, and you know, I always pay her more than she asked for because she's like $5, and I'm like, absolutely not, like I'm paying you city pet sitting prices. But last time she was like, can, instead of you paying me, can I just have a copy of your book? And I was like, you are too sweet, I will do both. Like, you can have a signed copy of my book and I will pay you. But she's very, very sweet and awesome, and like we talk, but it's just, again, small town, first name basis, like that's all that matters. And it's not like I'm being like, I don't need to know the help's last name. It was just kind of like, oh, like we just kind of are chill and it's fine. And I kind of like it. I'm still locking all my fucking doors and windows, but sure. I do kind of like having that vibe. And it's nice to be able, like every time I go out and check the mail, or I go out and sometimes I have to go look for, like there's been very windy lately. So I have to go look for like signs and shit that I put up in my yard. I have to go like scouring my property for them. And I always see someone that's like, just going for a walk and is awesome. Just once one lady has like a brigade of pugs. She's really sweet, but I like it. And I also, when I was out with my friends on this last vacation, they were asking me like, oh, how big is your town? And I'm like, I don't know. It's bigger than it was when I lived there. I guess it's like 300,000 people. And one of the friends I was with immediately looked it up and he's like, dude, your town is like 7,000 people. Like, it feels like 300,000 people live here.
Yeah.
It is a small fucking town, like 7,000 yeah. people. And it's very, very small. So, and it's spread out, but it's yeah. also small enough that I'm having lunch with the mayor.
Wow.
That was the other small town update I was going to give you, is that I went out for lunch with, again, my friend Sarah, who lives up the street. And we went into town and had lunch at the cafe owned by another person I went to high school with.
Wow.
And after we were done, we went across the street to the gift shop that the mayor owns. And he still works there a couple of days a week. And he was there. And Sarah used to work there in high school. All of my friends did, while I was working at the convent. And so she was like, hey, how's it going? Haven't seen you in a long time. And we were just chatting. And then I was like, why don't we all just get together for lunch one day? Like, I always see you kind of around, but we never really sit down. He's like, yeah, I want to like know what you're up to. And we were talking. I was like, yeah, like this town needs a bookstore and a movie theater and maybe I'll open one. And he's like, oh, let's sit down and talk it out. And so we're going out for lunch with the mayor.
<That's> amazing. I would love to know my mayor. I would love to know where my post office is. There's a lot of things right? that I don't get to do that you get to do.
You're like, I would like to know why I live in an unincorporated part of the city when I'm in the city.
Well, and that's yeah. I mean, I obviously didn't know that until I rented the house that I'm right. in, right? Because that obviously doesn't really mean a ton to renters in that
exactly.
way. I mean, it does sort of. Because then you realize, oh, wait, like an ambulance doesn't actually come to your house if you're having a heart attack.
No, you're in one of Meanwhile. Those like private ambulances. It's like Robert's ambulance. And you're like, okay, Robert, I guess I got to trust you on this one.
Yeah. Meanwhile, if I just went like 2 miles into like the city of Decatur, I get to go to a pool for free whenever I want. And I'm like, what the fuck am I doing here? Why did I just not rent a house 2 miles away and get all the accoutrements of a city. But Yeah, I don't know. I mean, honestly, like, I feel like that is just such a cute little arrangement that you have there. I'm telling you, dude, I am, as I get older, does anybody want to work this hard to be living? To live. I want a screen door, a rickety wooden screen door that just like slaps back and forth when people come in and out of it. You know, like if they need ingredients for things and to keep the windows open.
You can have that here.
Yeah.
I'm going to get you to move here one day. You're going to move here and we're going to start open a movie theater.
I mean, here's the thing about moving there. That's snow. I think I am post-snow. I am a post-snow person.
But here's the thing. If you live here, especially if you work remote, you don't have to deal with the snow. Somebody will plow your snow for you in your driveway. And you can get little heated pads for your walkway. And then you just stay inside for a day or so until it melts and you're fine.
Oh, man. But being cold is... I'm getting to be that person where I hate being cold. Like... So when I was in Europe, like a few weeks ago, like it was fucking, I mean, listen, I know that you get good deals to Europe when it's cold. I'm no dummy. I knew that. But I was also like, damn, it is fucking 30 degrees today. And I am like, and everybody is running around in like giant, you know, parkas with the fur collars and shit. And I was like, it was charming for about like 3 days. Like the first couple of days, I was like, oh, look how cozy it is here. It's like so cozy. And like, everybody's got like mitts and tees and, you know, boots. And then by the like fourth day, I was like, all right, I'm done. It is overcast. It is 30 degrees. I'm fucking depressed. I'm freezing. I want to go to Jamaica.
Yeah, I think the grayness is what gets you. Like the gray, the stretch of gray. So like taking, like going to Jamaica for a weekend was the fucking move for sure. Just like 3 days of sunshine was all I needed to get me through the rest of this fucking winter.
Yeah.
But you kind of just adjust. And also, again, like it's, you don't have to be here in the snow. You can have a kind of house situation where you're like, yeah, I got this little house. Danielle lives down the street. She'll come check my shit. And I'm going to go live somewhere else for the fucking winter.
Yeah. Oh, clearly you can find anybody to do anything for you there. No questions asked. I love that.
I went out. I went out and I pruned some of the trees. I guess they're technically part of the county or the town.
Yeah.
But they just weren't doing it. So I just pruned some trees and the neighbors... Like, there were some neighbors walking their dogs, and they were like, oh, thanks so much. Like, it looks so much better. And I was like, yeah, I just kind of, you know, it's kind of on my property, but kind of not. And I just don't want to wait for them. Like, you just kind of like, you know, it's a small town, man. You just make do.
Yeah.
It's real easy. Every time I drive into town, I know I'm going to get a parking space. I don't have to worry about parking anywhere.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
It's fucking nice.
Yeah.
It's what's weird about it, and the reason I wanted to give you these small town updates is that I feel like, even though I'm very much still locking everything, I'm kind of chilling out and getting reaccustomed to what this town is about. And that's like a goal of mine this year, is like to make friends here. And like, you know, I started volunteering at the library and like just kind of like
cute.
Yeah, like just, you know, just trying to get into the vibe here, because it is kind of a nice vibe and it's the reason people move here.
Yeah, I know. And like, that's the thing, is that you're very lucky. You have an incredible situation with your house, and I love like the life that you've made for yourself, and you should enjoy it, you know? And I'm going to come visit, obviously. I think actually I will be visiting very soon.
Oh yeah. We have got plans.
We do have plans. And like, I'm excited because, I have never been in that part of the world before. Like, I told you that. I think I said that, like, in an episode once. I've never been higher than, like, New York City.
Right.
So, and apparently there's, like, all these other states up there. So,
there's, like, five other states up here.
Yeah. And I'm going to make you drive me to, like, Vermont and New Hampshire. I'm going to make you drive me to where they make Ben and Jerry's. Can you do that for me?
Yes, I can. I could drive you to Montreal. I could drive. Yeah.
Let's go to Montreal. What are we thinking?
Oh, my God. It's the best city. It's That's where I was actually looking to buy something before I bought this house. I was like, maybe I'll live in Montreal. It's like one of my favorite cities, and it's not too far from New York. It's like an hour and a half by plane. And then I was like, when you got a grandma with dementia, you can't even live that far away. So,
yeah.
But I was literally looking at Montreal, and I think we got to go.
Oh,
we're going to fold it all in.
Put it on the Uber list. Let's hit it.
Put it on the fucking, it's put it on the calendar. But you're moving here eventually. Even if you do a halfsy-havesy, we're going to open a movie theater. You're going to program all the films. It's going to be great. There is a drive-in movie theater here, but it's not enough. We need an actual brick-and-mortar revival house movie theater.
Well, that's my whole life is sorted now, so I don't have to even think about how to live for the next 30 years. So
you can spend half the year in Jamaica and then spend half the year here.
Sounds like a plan.
We want to get into this theme?
I sure do, because this is all you. And the name of it is all you, and I laugh every time you say it. So
this week's theme is, I need a bacchiotomy. And I came up with that because I was kind of like thinking about, well, what are some movies that are really good to watch when you're like couch bound for any reason, whether you have a cold or some ache or some body aches, or, you know, just thinking about you taping up your knee. And I'm like, what are some good, like ice bagging those knees. And I'm like, what's a good movie to watch when you just don't want to move for a while and you don't want to get wrapped up in like a fucking binging a TV series. You just want to sit or lay down on the couch and feel better.
Yeah. I think that we kind of briefly talked about this on an old episode that we did with Allison Anders. Because I feel like the viewer letter that she answered had something to do with sick day movies or something.
Yep. And a lot of people ask us about that, like sick day movies.
Well, and I think, too, it's like a very specific set of conditions to watch movies because, you know, altered states of consciousness, be it like you're sick or you have a hangover or you have a bad knee or whatever. But then also you have the time and you kind of like have nothing else going on, which I think when she answered it, she kind of leaned towards like epics and Westerns and stuff, which is kind of how I feel, too. I mean, I feel like if you're going to sit there for a while and have like nothing else to do, why not watch something that's like very indulgent and
exactly,
big, you know?
Yeah. And but in the same vein, I think there are movies that are like that, that are not like part of a series or like, and these movies feel kind of big in that they're longer usually, like takes more time to watch them. You kind of have to, but they're also, I don't know, I kind of think like a good sick day couch movie for me is one where you're just instantly engrossed in the story and you just kind of can't wait to see what's going to happen next. But also it's one of those movies where like, if you fall asleep for 20 minutes, it's fine.
Yes. Oh, exactly.
Like, it's fine.
Would you say that, look, I'm going to admit something to you. I've never seen your movie.
This was your first time seeing my movie?
Oh, yeah. And like,
what?
Yeah, I know. I almost didn't admit that because I was like, that's shameful. Because that's Steven Spielberg classic. Seems like a lot of people our age love Steven Spielberg, wouldn't you say?
I am so glad you admitted it, though, because, I mean, to be fair, it came out in the 70s. So I thought you would have seen it because that's like the milieu.
Oh, yes, definitely on par for my interest, for sure. But for some reason, I got to admit, like, I have a couple of gaps like that, especially when it comes to these kind of huge directors like Spielberg.
Right.
And I just, you know, like, obviously with James Cameron, you know, I haven't seen Titanic, don't get on my case. But, you know, it's like, for some reason, there's like this moment where I think maybe that director is so famous, people will see that movie. I don't need to see it. Like they'll make enough money. He'll be successful enough without my ticket, right? But then it means that sometimes I lose, you know, the idea that these are movies that people connected to when they were kids. I know that's huge. Like a Spielberg movie is huge for people. And so I was wondering if maybe like your movie was like a comfort film for you or something. Did you watch it as a kid or?
Absolutely. Well, my movie this week is one of my grandmother and my mom's favorite movies. So it was constantly on whenever they, like, it was like one of the first things they bought on VHS when we got a VCR. Like it's one of those kind of movies.
Yeah.
And they just always loved it. And so there's parts of the movie that are just like burned into my brain. It came out the year I was born, but I've seen it so often. And it really holds up. Like, I'll talk about that when we get to the film, but there's just something about it that, because it was early Spielberg, it feels like it has that kind of, it still has a little bit of a kind of a dangerous mysteriousness to it, because you weren't quite sure where he was going to go.
Yes.
And you weren't like super wrapped up in like, oh, this is how he makes movies. So there's just something about it that is really just hits all the buttons for me. I don't know. And it's sci-fi enough, but there's also a lot of a human narrative to it.
Yeah.
And this is, again, a movie that it happens in the weirdest ways. Like, I'm never crying in a Merchant Ivory movie. I always cry at the end of this movie. Like, there are some sci-fi movies that just send me over the fucking edge. And it's like, I can't handle thinking about the expansiveness of the universe, or I don't know what it is, but I cry like a fucking baby every time I watch this movie.
Yeah. No, and that's the funny thing too, is that after I saw your movie, I immediately told myself, I think I fucked up the mission of this theme, because Danielle went for like a comforting childhood classic, you know, being sick on the couch, and I went for some fucking existential nightmare. I'm like, wow, we definitely went on different paths for this one.
But that's okay, because comfort means different things to different people. And that's, and I loved your movie. I love that you picked your movie for this, because it's also, again, it's a movie that I think your movie is one that a lot of people haven't seen, possibly because it feels too much. It's like a Bob Fosse. It's like got all these names and all this history with it. So a lot of people kind of feel like there's not a way into it, but it's totally watchable, especially if you're just like, I'm hanging out on the couch today. Yeah. Like, this is, I'm doing it. It's so great. It's perfect for this theme.
Well, awesome. I'm so excited because I'm going first this week. I have a lot of things to say about the movie from a personal perspective too, which I know this, you know, a lot of our themes are obviously personal, like, you know, kind of how we interpret things. But like this movie in particular, I think I watched and, you know, it really hit me in a very specific way. So I'm excited to talk about it. And I'm excited for this theme. Hilarious name.
I need a Bacchiotomy. And you know what movie that's from, guys, right? You know that's from Half-Baked.
Doctor said I need a Bacchiotomy.
What are we putting Half-Baked on the pod? Come on.
I know. Oh my gosh. Well, I'm so psyched. I definitely need a Bacchiotomy. I need some ice bags on my knees. And I can't wait to get into your movie. I have so many questions for you about this. And I kind of am loving that between last week's films and this week's films, like, we're really cracking open our skulls for the listeners.
We waited over 2 years to finally let you get to know us. All that shit was, we were just playing around. Now you're in. Now you can't escape.
This is like when my therapist was like, we should meet 2 days a week. And I'm like, oh, we're going deep. Okay, gotcha. After 5 years of me yammering for an hour a week, you're like, how about we talk about some real shit now? And I'm like, okay.
2 days a week. You're like, what?
Seriously. And she's got a whole plan. She's like, oh, we're going to hit that. I'm like, all right, let's hit it. Let's go for the hits. But she just had to wait till I was a little bit less mentally ill, which apparently took 5 years to get there.
Well, on that note, let's discuss my therapy for the week. So my movie for the theme, I Need a Bacchiotomy, is a movie from 1979. It was written by Robert Alan Arthur and Bob Fosse, directed by Bob Fosse, and it's called All That Jazz.
Oh, boy, do I hate show business.
No, you love show business.
That's right, I love show business. I'll go either way.
Well, look, I mean, I'll admit something to you again, something shocking, maybe, perhaps, not really for me, but this movie was a recent watch for me too. I only saw this movie in the past couple years, I think. Nice. But right away, it became an obsession, basically.
Yeah?
Yes, because I think it hits for me on several different levels. Number one, as a person who more or less had a near-death experience a few years ago, which that plays into this movie very much. And number two, as a person who has a very deep love for a very specific time and place, which is anything that involves people who are living in New York City in the late 70s or early 1980s who are trying to make it in show business, specifically Broadway. or any kind of dance, professional dance job. Okay. Like, if you listen to this very early episode that we did about dance conservatory movies, you already yeah. know this about me.
Absolutely. I mean, this is so your wheelhouse. You're like, I want to see some fucking struggle. I need to see those pit stains. I need to see those fucking. Whenever I see a leotard soaked in sweat, I'm like, this is Millie's fucking wheelhouse right here.
Invariably, there'll be like a very hairy dude that has like chest hair coming out of the deep V of his male leotard, and it fucking sends me. I just love this era. I really know. It's very, like I said, it's very specific, and I have an obsession over it. That's why when we talked about Fame on that episode, I was like, fucking put it in my veins. I love Fame. I love, you know.
You like, love an original set of yellow teeth, crooked yellow teeth with like those black molars showing.
I love anybody who wears like a pashmina over a leotard when they're like teaching the class. Like
one dancer in this. Well, obviously there's several dancers in this movie, but there's one dancer in particular in this movie who has like she rolls her pantyhose, or like she rolls her leotard down over and has like a pair of underwear on top of it. And I'm like, if you could wear that every day, I know you would. I know.
Oh
you
my
would.
God. Trust. Oh, you don't even get it. I would wear like very dark pantyhose with underwear over it, rolled down waistband with like a bra, like a very skimpy sports bra. Oh my God. Don't even get me started. And then like a nude character shoe. Come on.
Exactly.
with a leg warmer rolled over it. Oh my God.
No, this is definitely one of those movies where, like, you can see and feel the struggle just in, like, what their bodies are doing. And I love it.
100%. I mean, and this is actually interesting, too, about me. Not that I'm interesting, but you know what I'm saying.
You are.
I, as much as I do love dancing, and I just worship people who dance well, and I like, wish I could be a dancer, I actually don't know a ton about, like, the history of Broadway or, like, musical theater. And
yeah.
In fact, I mean, I was not a theater kid growing up. I just wasn't. And I, to be honest, sort of hated it as a kid. I don't know why. I just think I had, you know.
When you're younger, I think that people make it so much part of their identity that it can be a little bit grating. If you're not into it all the way, they make it seem like you can't be into it at all.
And I was actually in drama club. Like, that's the thing. I was in drama club because a lot of my friends were in drama club. And I just was like, I just want to hang out with my friends. I do not want to be an actor.
I'm picturing you going up to the teacher first day and being like, look, I'm here to hang out. Do not assign me a fucking part. I'm not doing the fucking cherry orchard. I'm not doing the fucking any of this shit. Yes. Just let me hang out with my friends. I'll be quiet. I'll be sitting in the back and you just do your thing.
Well, and like, and so that's the thing, is that has changed a lot as I've gotten older. Now I love this old Broadway stuff. Like I love that kind of, like, we're going to talk about Fosse obviously, but like Sweet Charity, like the, you know, I love, you know, any kind of like old, like Busby Berkeley musicals. Like I love Fred Astaire. So like all this stuff now is very charming to me. But when I was young, I was too cool for theater. I got to admit I was. But
I've always loved this shit. I've always loved it. But in the same vein, I feel like as much as I've always loved musicals and I've always loved this medium, I also don't know a lot about individuals. So like, I don't know a ton about Sondheim. I don't know a ton about Fosse. Yeah. And I want to, but I feel like that's just going to involve me putting in the effort to like really dig it. Like I had Julie Klausner, friend of the pod, former guest.
Yes. Yes.
I told her, I'm like, I don't think I've ever really listen to Sondheim, like beyond like West Side Story. And she put together a playlist for me immediately.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of how you get in. I think you just kind of have to dip in a toe, like with all that jazz.
To the point though, I feel like even if you don't like theater, you certainly have heard of Bob Fosse, right? Because he's just like an icon of dance and theater production and movies.
Totally.
You know, he basically created his own style of dance because I gotta tell you, if you've ever thrown a jazz hand in your life, you can thank Bob Fosse for that. That's his. So know that about yourself if you don't like theater, but you've thrown jazz hands, okay? But what I think is interesting about Bob Fosse, too, is that he directed a handful of films. And, you know, he started out with stuff like Sweet Charity and Cabaret, obviously. But then, you know, his last movie was Star 80. Mm-hmm. But all that jazz, I think, for him was very specifically a project that was about his life. It's essentially an autobiography fantasy.
Right.
That was based on his real life during the mid-70s as he was editing Lenny, which is the biopic that he directed of Lenny Bruce starring Dustin Hoffman, while also staging Chicago, the musical, and recovering from a major heart attack and open heart surgery all at the same time.
Like packing it in.
Yes.
Homeboy did not know how to take a break.
Right. And like that is the movie. Because a one-sentence synopsis of this movie would be a famous director and choreographer has a dreamlike reckoning when he's faced with a lifetime full of hard living and selfishness after suffering a major coronary event.
Wonderful.
So, as I alluded to, Fosse's avatar in All That Jazz is this man named Joe Gideon, and he's played by the great Roy Scheider. Roy Scheider, as you probably know, was absolutely in the fucking zone in the 70s because he started out with Clute, moved through The French Connection, Jaws, Marathon Man, Sorcerer, and of course this movie. And I got to tell you, just like his character in Jaws, he continues to be the king of acting with a cigarette hanging out of his mouth.
Yeah. Yes.
Do we have another actor in the history of modern cinema who is as good as him at that? I don't know.
I don't even want to speculate.
don't
want to speculate.
I couldn't even think of another. But he, in this movie, his whole vibe and his look is an obsession for me. Okay. It's like a swashbuckler meets a gay choreographer.
I mean, the shoes alone. If you look at his shoe action in this movie, there's one point where he has like garbage bags tied or like cinched around. I think they're leg warmers, but they just look like he's just cinched some garbage bags around.
Yeah. Yeah. Feet. And he's got always in these very tight black clothes with like four or five buttons unbuttoned on the shirt. Like, chest is out all the time. He's got these, like, kind of, like, black pirate-looking boots with, like, the leg warmers, the trash bag leg warmers over it. And he's just constantly smoking. I feel like Roy Scheider, like, he's very thin in this movie, and I don't know if he did something. Like, did he do a Christian Bale move where he lost a bunch of weight or something? Right. He definitely bleached his hair because he's got like a little goatee, but his hair looks a little lighter. But all of this is to say he looks amazing in this movie. And here's the thing. So at the very beginning of the film, Joe Gideon he's getting up out of bed, gets in the shower with a cigarette, mind you, showering with a cigarette in his mouth. So right off the bat.
The 70s were so gross.
They were so gross.
The 70s were fucking depraved. Okay.
Good Lord. You know, you really got to be addicted to cigarettes if you're going to smoke in the shower. That just seems unbelievable to me. But so he's in the shower. This classical music song's playing in the background. Then he, you know, downs a couple Alka-Seltzers, some amphetamines, puts some Visine in the eyes, and then he finally, like, looks himself in the mirror, claps his hands, and tells himself, it's showtime, folks.
Love it.
And you soon realize that this is his daily routine.
Like, to a T, every part of that is every day. For him.
Every day. It's a hell of a way to start the day for this guy, because I gotta tell you, he's the type of dude who's professionally been on the brink of death since birth. And he's one of those folks that, like, he knows just how to barely maintain himself to live another day. Okay. Right. Like, you're smoking in the shower. You're taking amphetamines every day. You're like, he drinks and smokes to excess. He has way too many pills in his system. He womanizes. But then also he works around the clock. And his life is just like this endless ball of stress. But here's the thing. He loves it.
Yeah.
He loves it and he doesn't want to stop, right? So that's where you're getting with Joe Gideon, right? Now, right after this is probably my favorite part of the movie. We have already alluded to it, but this might be my favorite part of any movie in history. I don't know. But you basically go from Joe's bathroom to this stage full of dancers, and they're packed in like sardines. They're in their tights and their leotards and their sweaty pits, and they're doing this routine for a tryout, okay? And most importantly, this scene is set to George Benson's On Broadway, which is a song that I love so much. If you hate this song, I hate you. I'm just gonna put it out there. He recorded it live in West Hollywood in the 70s, and it plays like, you know, the song. You've heard it on, like, the radio, I'm sure, especially as you were a kid. But, like, this song is it. They say the neon lights are bright on Broadway. His version is so perfect for this time period that I'm obsessed with, right?
I love that you're like, let me lay it down. I hate you if you don't love this. This is my point of entry.
Yes. If you hate On Broadway by George Benson, you are dead to me. Seriously. But, you know, look, this is all happening. It's very glamorous. Joe is at the center and he's like hiring and firing dancers. He's making people cry. He's, you know, it's mesmerizing because you're like, oh, here's what it's like to be on Broadway. It's like mm-hmm. a cattle call and then only the strong survive. But
and he's like showing the moves and everything. I love when he does that, when he's like, here's how it should be done.
Yes. Yes. And like, and Roy Scheider, like, you know, obviously, I don't know if he had like classical dance training ever in his career, but like he plays the part very well. Like he's very believable as this character. So he's casting this musical, obviously, which instead of being called Chicago, which is what Fosse was actually doing in his real life, in the film, it's called New York, LA. Okay. And at the same time, it's cutting back from all these tryouts to him, you know, at the studio editing footage of a film that he's directed, very similar to Lenny, obviously, but it's called The Stand-Up. And it's basically like he's in this weird, obsessive period of editing where he's fixated on this very specific part and he wants to get it perfect. And everybody in the studio is like, let it go. Like, you're out of time. You're out of budget. Like, stop obsessing over this thing. But you can't talk him out of it. He's just completely manic at this point, right?
Yeah.
And
obsession could be a connective point between both of our films.
Oh, my God. Absolutely. It's like, what happens when men leave their wife and children to follow a passion?
That's the real theme.
There's always an alternate theme that surfaces. Oh, shit. Well, so, okay. To that point, though, Joe's family starts showing up, and you meet his girlfriend, who is named Katie. She's played by Anne Reinking, who was Fosse's real-life girlfriend during this period of his life, right? And in the film, Joe is constantly cheating on Katie, as you can imagine, specifically with a woman he literally just hired to be in New York, LA, right? And in fact, Katie walks in on them in bed together. So that's how he rolls, okay? I think you know that by now. But then you also meet his ex-wife, Audrey, who is played by Leland Palmer. Yes, it's the same name as the dad from Twin Peaks. I don't actually know if David Lynch did that on purpose, but I love that little fact.
Let's start it. Let's start the rumor that Leland Palmer in Twin Peaks was named so because All That Jazz is David Lynch's favorite movie.
Yes. Let's just, like, change the Wikipedia. Casey, yeah. Change the Wikipedia right now.
Check with the lawyers.
So here's the thing about Audrey, his ex-wife. Like, she was apparently modeled after Gwen Verdon, who was Fosse's wife and muse and longtime collaborator. And so, you know, there's all this these characters that are based off of real people in Fosse's life, obviously. And then you also meet his preteen daughter named Michelle. And the thing about Michelle is, like, you can tell that Joe has a genuine love for his kid. But at the same time, he knows that he disappoints her and that he's just constantly a schmuck. So he kind of knows the stuff about him already. And the thing
I
about
feel like
it,
Michelle grows up to be Lana Del Rey.
Well, you know what's really funny? This is a side note, but I recently read Jennifer Grey's autobiography.
Oh.
From, you know, Dirty Dancing, I think you know Jennifer Grey. And her father was Joel Grey, who was in Cabaret. And, like, she grew up in this kind of life, right? Like, this kind of New York performers, like, Broadway acting, like, life. And so every time I saw Michelle in the movie, this rewatch, I kept thinking about that Jennifer Grey autobiography, because I was like, oh, she's like the real life Michelle, right?
Yeah.
Where her dad's this, like, performer, and, you know, her parents have this, like, crazy modern relationship, and they got friends, and there's, like, anyway, it's fascinating. But I feel like the thing that I love about this, though, is that all three of these characters, like Audrey, Michelle, and Katie, they're all professional dancers. Like, the actresses playing them are professional dancers, which I think is really great, because it obviously kicks in later as Joe's kind of having his, like, hallucinations, right? Now, I think obviously what makes this movie a sick day movie for me is that it's basically like, yes, you're, like, in this glamorous fever dream all the time of Joe. Where it's going back and forth between, like, his kind of present reality of, like, the tryouts and the editing and stuff. But then it's also presenting sort of his inner reality, too, which is expressed through these conversations that he's having with this woman in white, right? And you eventually deduct that this woman is the Angel of Death. And she's played by Jessica Lange, right? And so when they're talking, it's kind of like the first time you're really kind of getting sort of like a look into, like, what he's actually thinking about his whole life. And, you know, he tells this woman, this Angel of Death character, that he is a shithead and he is a disappointment to his kid and his wife. And he does live too hard. And then, of course, in real life, you know, all of these things, the stress, the boozing, the smoking, they catch up to him. Joe has a major heart attack. And it's pretty much told by the doctors, like, straight up, you need to relax, you need to clean up your act, like, no more dilly-dallying, because you will die. And of course he doesn't, because he's in the hospital smoking and drinking, and he's, like, screwing the nurses, and, you know, it's like, he doesn't give a shit.
It's still a party. It's still a party. And that, to me, is, like, a really interesting aspect of this film, is that Fosse is kind of seems to be projecting, you know, since this is a movie about his own life and his own experiences, that he's projecting almost, like, he knows that he's going too far, too fast, too much. And he takes it to an extreme conclusion that didn't end up happening to him. But it's like you're watching him process his own life and death. It's very, very cool and weird.
Yeah, and like the rest of the movie at this point becomes very dreamlike, right? Because he's imagining these events in his life, you know, he's imagining his life and death as these musical numbers, right? And all the women in his life are performing numbers about how he's such a shithead and how he can't ever give up his vices. And, you know, and there are times where he's imagining himself directing his own death, which is pretty crazy. And like I said, I think at the beginning, you know, these are parts of the movie that I think are really impactful for me personally, because, you know, obviously, like, I went through a pretty big illness, like, a few years ago, and I was in the ICU and I had had surgeries and I was hopped up on all the drugs, right? And when you're in that situation, if you've ever been in that situation, unfortunately, like, you're just in this passive mode, right? Because you're being taken to like strange places with people standing over you. And it's weird because I feel like if like in a weird way, like this, these moments of the film felt like they were happening to me when I was in that situation too. I mean, it's just like this absurd performance of things that you just have to sit there and bear witness to because you're sick, right?
Yeah, it's such a weird choreography of like people coming in and out and you don't understand what they're saying and they're talking in terms you don't understand about you. It's like so strange.
Yeah, it just, and it is something that I had never been to the hospital before, you know, before I actually did go to the hospital. And I don't know, I guess I just was always living in a fear of it ever happening. But then when I was in the moment, I was like, yeah, this is all just like a weird dream. And I just sit there and watch it happen. And there's also this moment too that really, really hits me where, you know, Joe eventually, he's recovering and he's having these dreams and these conversations and stuff like in his head. And then he eventually gets tired of being in the room and he actually escapes and like starts wandering around the hospital. And there's this part where he goes to this random older lady's room and he kisses her and he tells her that he loves her. And there's like this moment that I remember when I was in the hospital, where I felt this like huge wave of love. Like my heart just felt like so open. And I remember feeling like this weird kind of like genuine, pure love for like the people that were coming to visit me and like the nurses and stuff. It was very wild. It was very, it was a very wild moment. And it was definitely the drugs. But I'm just saying, when that happens, like in the movie, I'm like, yo, I totally get this. You know, like this feeling of like, I just love you and I love everything. And it's just
right.
Not to get too deep and weird, but I'm just saying I felt like I can connect to that in a weird way.
Well, no, I think that's important because when I see that scene as someone who's not had a near-death experience or spent an extended amount of time in the hospital, I think, you know, it hit a little bit differently. And I felt like, oh, is this just him expressing a guilt that he had about like not loving his own mother enough, not, you know, because we do go back to his own life. As we go through his life, we go back to the beginnings of his life. And for me, it was more like wondering, is he questioning his own actions? So I love hearing that, like, oh yeah, it might be because of the drugs, but like, this is a real feeling that people have when they're in that situation.
Yeah. And like, and that's, I think why, I mean, I will say that when I first saw this movie, I was a lot closer to that event for me. Like, well, I was a lot closer to it than I was this time, obviously, watching it. And it was triggering. Like, I mean, there were moments where I felt very triggered by what was happening, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that as the years have gone on, I've gotten like, you know, you just move further and further away from a traumatic event and you're able to think about it and process it more. But in this weird moment, I was also like connected to it. Like there were times where I thought, oh, maybe this is too much. I shouldn't be watching this movie where, you know, a guy is contemplating and directing his own death. And, you know, it's like all about those hospital footage scenes and all that shit. And I'm like, this is too much for me. But then I just kind of was like, but also like, I feel like connected to this and I'm going to stick with it. And I'm just glad I did because I think it, I don't know. I think it just hit me like in a different way.
Yeah. And did you see it for the first time after you were hospitalized?
Correct. Yeah, I did. I did.
And that, wow.
Yeah. So I, you know, like I said, I was like, what am I doing watching this weird movie where it felt like I was in a lot of these scenarios in a weird way. But then I also, there was like an artistry to the movie that made it like almost like I could handle it.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Versus watching something like ER or something where I'm like, this is immediate and intense and there's no filter of song and dance through it. You know what I mean? Like,
what ER needs is a fucking musical number to bring some of this drama down.
Some of these fucking doctors need to be wearing top hats. Come on. Can we get Noah Wiley in some fucking character shoes? What the fuck?
Oh, God. Yeah.
But you know what I mean? Like, it just felt like a little bit, I think the theatrics of it helped me kind of move through that. Like I said, when we were coming up with movies for this theme, it took me a while. I think it was like a very last minute choice for me. But then I was like, of course, because it was like, it is the movie that I think I could watch and have watched like when I'm on the couch, sort of just experiencing like, you know, a cold or, you know, a hangover. It does feel like something that feels like a dream, you know?
Right.
And the other thing that I love about this movie, too, is that there's a lot of cameos in the film of people that we know now. But back right. in this, you know, 79, they were probably all just working actors. So, I mean, there are so many people in this movie. I mean, like, you spoke about there's early scenes of, like, Joe as a child working in, like, the burlesque circuit. And, like, the, you know, Keith Gordon plays Joe Gideon as a child. And he's very young. I was like, wow, I forgot that that's Keith Gordon. But you have like John Lithgow, Ben Vereen. There's like a huge scene of him performing towards the end of the film. Wallace Shawn, fucking CCH Pounder is in this movie. Like she's a nurse. I'm like, and like maybe even more shocking or the most shocking is the fucking dad from Alf is in this movie.
Max Wright. Max Wright is in this movie. And when you see him, it's if you know anything about the scandalous end of his life, it is really wild to see him as like a younger man in this movie knowing what's coming.
I don't know anything about what what happened to the dad. What are you telling
Wait,
me?
Wait, what?
I knew that. Okay, I knew that the guy who created Alf. Because isn't that what Permanent Midnight is about? Yes. Is like, he was a drug addict at one point. So you're telling me the dad from Alf, something else actually happened with the dad from Alf too?
Alf, let's just say that Alf was an enabler. He was the gateway for a lot of people. And it's kind of a sad story, but Max Wright ended up, there are photos of him smoking crack cocaine. And he was involved with, like, gay porn. And, like, his, the end of his life was very scandalous.
Wow.
Yeah, like, there, wow. Like in the news. Like, in I remember in the news and in the newspapers, it was him and Marion Barry. They're like, I'm like, these hotel cams do not miss.
What happened with the show Alf? Is it, like, a tainted production? Like, what?
I know,
like,
it's cursed.
What is up?
Alf is cursed. I think everyone else came out kind of unscathed. Like, the daughter is a yoga teacher now. And I think the son joined the military or something like that.
Whoa!
But yeah, Alf was not fucking around.
Damn, how did I not know you have this party trick about knowing about everyone's after Alf life?
Because it was so shocking to me that I'm like, this was a family show on like NBC at 8 o'clock. Yeah. Like a typical sitcom. And then when you read about the background of it, you're like, I will never forget this. That this is what was going on behind this like lighthearted family show.
Well, and that's the thing is that when he shows up in the movie, I was like, who is that? I know that guy. Mm-hmm. You know, you have that moment. And then you're like, oh, it's the dad from Alf. And wow, what anything you just told me has just blown me away. That's unbelievable.
Yeah, and well, sad. And he even like, you know, he died of a cancer-related illness, I believe. And like but he spoke about how the time of his life where he was doing drugs kind of derailed his career.
Wow.
And it's really sad because it was kind of the end of his life and he didn't know
wow.
that. I know wow. a lot of sad shit, folks. A lot of sad shit.
It's information that I needed because I didn't know any of that. Well, and here's the last thing I'll say too about all that jazz. You know, besides the fact that you know I've shared a lot of personal information of why I'm so connected to this movie, but also there's this amazing performance sequence in the film where Joe is basically showing off his like latest number for New York, LA to like the investors or whatever. And I'll always remember it not only because it's basically about like an erotic airline. Where it's like all these airline stewards and stewardesses like being like, hi, welcome to like the topless airline or whatever. It's like very it's hilarious to me when I watch it. But also this sequence by the way, might be the best dance sequence of the whole movie. I have to say, yeah, these dancers are fucking unbelievable. These have like the most unbelievable bodies and the most unbelievable athletic prowess. It's incredible. But also, it was the inspiration for Paula Abdul's Cold Hearted video.
No!
Yes, which I was obsessed with as a child.
That there's makes even a so part, much sense.
Yeah, there's even a part at the beginning of the Paula Abdul video where the record execs are coming to see them dance, and he says, oh, it's supposed to be like a Fosse thing. So...
Oh, that makes so much sense. Because I'm like, why is, as a kid, I'm like, why is she dancing on scaffolding? What's going on here?
Yeah, why are they humping on scaffolding? But now you know where it comes from,
now
all that
I
jazz.
Know.
So anyway, if you haven't seen this movie and felt like maybe you didn't want to because it's like related to the theater or something, don't. It's more than that. It's very visually stunning. It is a great kind of sit there and let it soak in type of film. And if you got a couple hours to spare, it's a good time. So
absolutely. I'm so glad you picked this. I'm so glad to revisit this movie at any point in time. And it's perfect for this theme. Perfect.
Thank you. Well, look, let's crack yours wide open because first watch for me.
Cannot wait to talk about this because this is your first watch. I didn't know. So this is a movie that was released in 1977, the best year because the year I was born. The screenplay is by Steven Spielberg. It was directed by Steven Spielberg. And my movie is Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
What do you want?
I just want to know that it's really happening.
Beep, ah, beep, ah, beep, ah, boop.
Beep, boop, beep, boop, beep. So your first question might be, what are the first two fucking encounters? And I'm going to tell you. So the first... Why the third kind? Let me tell you. Because the first encounter with alien life is a sighting. So you just see something. See a UFO, you see some shit. The second encounter is physical evidence. So like they've dropped something, like, you know, they dropped a log off the fucking plane or something.
See.
The third encounter is contact. So that's why this is Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Okay, I'm so glad that you cleared that up for me because I was in a moment going, is this the third time that the aliens have come?
You're like, is it because there's three ships? Like-,
like the first kind was fun, the second kind was sad, and the third kind is, I don't know, like zany? I don't know.
It's the jazz hands Fosse version.
Fuck.
And I, you know how I know this, and I'm sure it's part of some like larger chart that I should have researched or looked at. I know this because I remember it from the movie poster. This movie, like I remember it from the box, like the VHS box.
I gotta say, for somebody who roasts me every week for doing research and providing geeky information about things, you fucking bring it sometimes, and I appreciate that shit. I'm so glad I know what this third kind thing is. This is amazing.
I don't want anyone getting hung up on what kind it is and then not being able to enjoy the movie.
Yes.
So perfect. I'm like, let me give you that information and then we can just move forward. Because there's so many different ways to contact a fucking alien, apparently. And we're on the third kind. We're coming in hot. So this movie, my one sentence synopsis is... An ordinary dad sees a UFO and it becomes the obsessive point of his life.
100%.
So this is a movie that has a great cast. Richard Dreyfuss plays one of the main characters, Roy Neary, and his family includes Terry Garr and a couple of kids, but like all 70s heavy hitters. The other affected person, we'll say, in the movie is Melinda Dillon, who you might know from A Christmas Story. Mm-hmm. She was a mom in The Christmas Story, amongst many other things, and she plays Jillian and her son, Barry, who is the cutest little kid, and I've got some background information about him, too. So these are kind of like the main players, but we also have Francois Truffaut playing Lacombe, who's like the main scientist that we're going to deal with, and his sidekick slash translator is Bob Balaban. And you know I love nothing more on this podcast than when we get a surprise Balaban. surprise Balaban experience.
A surprise and delight Balaban is always a good sign.
Completely. And he's kind of like a mirror for Spielberg, I feel like, in this film, in that, you know, you kind of are introduced to these scientists as they're in the desert, you know, they're in Mexico, and they're kind of, we realize shortly after this first scene that they're kind of following sightings of UFOs. Yeah. And one thing that was interesting to me, I haven't seen it yet, but The Fabelmans is a recent movie that Spielberg released this last year, and it's autobiographical about him growing up in Arizona. And apparently, I think the reason that I'm kind of making this connection now on like my 90th viewing of this movie is that Bob Balaban like has the beard and the glasses and everything, but there was something about the time that he spent in the desert that I think is discussed in The Fabelmans. Again, haven't seen it. That kind of influenced him wanting to make this film and these kinds of films. So that was very interesting to me this time around. I also read in Vulture an article that's called With E.T. Close Encounters, Spielberg Told the Same Sad Story from Different Eyes. Mm. And in that article, they discuss how he was inspired by watching meteor showers with his dad when he was younger to make this film. Yeah. And there's a quote from that article that I want to read. Neary's big priority shift, a kind of religious conversion, comes at the expense of the people who once gave his life meaning. So that is a big thrust of the film, is that there is a point, and it's like midway through the film, where his obsession becomes so intense that his family leaves. And so in this article, what they're saying is E.T. is telling that story from a different perspective, because E.T. is about a single mom with three kids, or a mom with three kids who's recently split from her husband. So the dad's not there. And I never thought of it that way, where they're kind of different sides of the same coin, where they have this alien interaction.
Yeah.
But it's like after the dad had this obsession with aliens. So I think that's kind of cool and interesting that this writer, I think it was A.A. Dowd, who wrote that, who made that connection. And E.T. also, looking for facts about this movie, E.T. was not a sequel to Close Encounters, but it was inspired by Close Encounters, because in one of the last scenes, there is an alien that comes out, a puppet, and Spielberg thought, as he was watching it back, what if that alien didn't leave? What if he stayed? So that is where the inspiration for E.T. came from. I love this shit because I just love digging into the minds of creative people and figuring out, like, where does that idea come from? If you can even pinpoint it, because sometimes you can't. But, like, if you can pinpoint it, where's that come from?
Yeah.
So it comes from this movie. And this movie was inspired by the meteor showers he watched with his dad. It's all connected, folks. There's also a behind-the-scenes video that's part of the 20th Anniversary Collector's Edition, which you can find online if you're looking for it. And it's definitely worth seeing if you love this movie.
Yeah, that was one thing that I did make sure of, because, you know, I think to your earlier point about how, you know, this movie feels like a very early Spielberg movie, and that it's kind of like a little unpredictable in that way. Like, you can tell he's moving through a lot of different ideas.
Yeah.
And I always feel that that's the case whenever there's like lots of director's cuts, quote unquote. Like, there's a lot of different cuts of a movie, where directors come back and re-edit things and add things and that kind of stuff. And that was the one thing that I really wanted to make sure I got right, was when I watched this for the first time, I'm like, all right, what's his version? What's the version that he has sanctioned, you know? Yes. And it is that, like, whatever director's cut version is, that 137-minute version, which I think is, like, his most complete vision or whatever, so.
Same. I watched the director's cut. I own the director's cut. But I watched the director's cut because I do feel like when a director's cut is available that I should watch it. Like, I should see how it was meant to be seen. And sometimes it adds a different flavor or gives me different thoughts, or kind of, like, you know, has scenes in it that explain things more or make things more confusing. But I feel like it's worth it to watch, you know, what the most pure version of that movie is.
Yeah. And we, you know, it's funny because that is something that I think a lot of like hardcore cinephiles really care about, almost like too much in a weird way. Like they're very passionate about runtimes and versions and stuff. And I think a lot of like casual film people like don't really care. But I think in the cases of things like this, it is important. Like if you want to watch like the movie the director intended to make, you know, you will have to seek out a director's cut or like, you know, whatever kind of special edition or whatever that director has. And a lot of times, like when home video companies put out releases, you know, sometimes those DVDs or those versions that are on Amazon or wherever aren't the versions that the director, like you have to actually seek it out. And like, you might have to buy it. You might have to buy the Blu-ray or get, but you know, it takes a little bit of legwork. But if that's something you want, if you want to see like the purest version of a movie from the director's perspective, then you'll have to care, I guess.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, I completely agree. And it's worth it. Like, I think that, again, I've seen this movie so many times. When I first watched the director's cut, there were things in there that I didn't see the first few times I'd watched it. And it changed the story for me, or made the story, I should say, it made the story deeper for me. Because usually the director's cut is not meant to be confusing. It's not meant to be, you know, kind of adding things that don't make sense. It's meant to kind of deepen the story and help with the narrative. So it really did that for me the first time I saw the director's cut. And I loved it. Because I'm like, this is a movie I'm familiar with. It won't be that different. And it really was.
Yeah. And to your point, though, especially about this movie, just from, you know, basically reading the Wikipedia article before I press play, you know, there was a lot of like studio notes, too, which they wanted certain scenes to happen and Spielberg didn't or whatever. So, yeah, I mean, it is in that way important to see his version of it. So
I love it. And I love that there's something that... Like, this is a movie that when you meet the Neary family, when you meet Jillian, they're in Muncie, Indiana. But through the scientists, we get this more expansive view of what these UFO sightings mean to people. So there's a scene in Mexico where they're talking to this man who has a sunburn on his face, and he says, the sun came out at night and sang to me. And at first you're like, what is he talking about? And it is explained. But then you get to see these scientists in India, where people who have seen this UFO sighting are kind of chanting the same five notes over and over again. And there's something, I think that's why I get so emotional about shit like this and why I get so emotional about sci-fi movies. There's something so connective of thinking about ourselves as a micro part of a huge universe. And so whenever sci-fi movies start to connect countries and nations and, you know, things where we've arbitrarily made these man-made decisions about what separates us. Mm-hmm. A lot of, I think, my connection to sci-fi is that it's more about what unites us. So I just really love those scenes in the movie as well. And that chant, that five-note chant, is a really crucial part of the storyline. And John Williams did the music for this movie, and he does the music for most of Spielberg's movies. But it's this five notes system that I think, what did they base it on? They based it on the solfège system of musical education. So if you're familiar with music at all, feel free to tell me what that is. But it's based on something real. And it took them a long time to figure out like what the five notes would be. So again, all of the details of this film are very, very, very interesting. And they gel in such a way that by the time they're telling the full story, it just becomes, again, so much more emotional for me. So the way we're first, you know, introduced to these notes is with this chant. And then we see it through the characters. So what basically happens is one night in Muncie, Roy is this electrician. He gets a call because all the electricity is going out all over town and nobody can figure out what's going on. And we're seeing this event happened through two different sets of eyes. So first we have Roy, who's like, you know, one person that we have is Roy, who's like running around at work. They're trying to figure it out. There's one guy in the scene who's like, "Yeah, just let it break and we'll fix it when it's done." And I'm like, I do not ever want to meet that guy. I hate that guy. I don't want to know that guy.
Cutting like, corners guy.
Yeah, cutting corners guy. He's like, let the whole thing fail and then we'll figure out what happened. And I'm like, hate that. But then we also get to see this experience through Barry's eyes. And Barry is this 3-year-old. He's Jillian's son. And he's played by Cary Guffey. And he, all of the toys in his room start coming on. And like the TV comes on in his mom's room. Like there's an electrical event happening that wakes him up. And he goes down to his kitchen. It looks like there's a fucking frat party that happened. Like the refrigerator is just like smashed open. Everything's pulled out. And he kind of goes outside and he's running around and he's laughing. And his mom wakes up and is like, "What the fuck?" And she goes to get him. And he ends up like he's running. Like he's running up a hill. And she kind of follows him up this hill. And he almost gets hit by a truck. And the truck is driven by Roy Neary. Because Roy is sent out for work to investigate one of these outages. And the same kind of electrical shit happens to him. So he's sitting in his truck at a railroad stop and shit just starts going haywire. And his truck turns off and like papers are flying and like the mailboxes are rattling next to him. Like it is just like everything is like there's something happening that he cannot describe. So he then sees, he looks up in the sky and he sees this dark ship just passing through the night. And they're so creepy and eerie. It's something that I really love about this movie is that the way they use sound or don't use sound is so important because in that moment, you have all this commotion going on and then it stops. All the lights in town are out and there's just this kind of hint of a ship just floating through the sky. So he decides to fucking follow it. He's like, "I'm gonna go see what the hell this is all about." Like his obsession point is almost immediate. And so as he's driving crazily trying to figure out like what this thing is and where it's going, and he's listening, like once his truck comes back on, he's hearing all these reports of people sighting this thing as well. And he almost hits Barry as he drives up this hill. That's how he meets Jillian. And these three little ships come down, these three dots of light just kind of come down. And I have to say that for a movie that is 45 years old, somehow the graphics still hold up. Like it doesn't come across as cheesy. It doesn't come across as like, you know, you're looking at like an old Ed Wood movie with like a fucking flying saucer on a string. It
yeah,
really
it's not
kind
like the
holds
cover of an ELO album or whatever.
Exactly. No, it holds up. And so they just kind of are on top of this hill with one or two other people, like a family and a guy. And they have this kind of shared experience together. And then the ships go away and everyone has to go home and go back to their lives. But what they don't realize is that having shared this event, they've all kind of been infected by a thought. Mm-hmm. And the thought is this image of this kind of mound they can't explain. And Roy's got like, you know, like the half sunburned face and he's kind of explaining to his wife, like, we got to go and see this thing. Like it's super special. And she gets in the car and they go out and nothing happens. And she's skeptical almost instantly. Like she goes along with it the first night, but then she's like, I don't love this. Even though there are reports in the paper of a UFO sighting.
Right.
So everyone's kind of seeing this image. And then they're also hearing those five notes. So Barry starts playing them on his little toy xylophone, but they're all individually afflicted. And they don't know that they've all been individually afflicted. So we're seeing it play out in each individual character. One thing that is hilarious to me about the UFO scene that first night is that the cops are chasing the ships. And you're like, why? Why are you cops chasing the ships that are clearly from another planet, like zipping through the sky? But also what cracks me up is the ships at one point, they raise the gates at a toll booth and just kind of slide in. And I'm like, that's really polite. Like, they didn't just smash through the gates. They raised them up.
Yeah.
It's so polite. So Roy gets his whole family and is like, I have had this vision. I see this shape. His wife is skeptical. And then he goes back out the next night to look, and it's a fucking party. Jillian is there, and she also kind of has a sunburn, so they're talking about how weird it is. And he sees Barry making this shape in the mud. And that's when Roy starts to realize, like, we are having a shared experience here. Like, we're both seeing this shape, and we don't know why. And they're obsessively starting to kind of make the shape everywhere you go. So one thing that makes... For me, that makes this a really good couch, sick day, bacchiotomy movie is that there's so much to dig into right away, because even though we're focusing on Roy Neary, we're looking at this event from the perspective of so many different eyes. And that is never more true than when we see Barry get abducted. So prior to this, we've got the French team chasing the UFOs. They come to the U.S. They've been working with these five notes that they heard in India. And Bob Balaban's the one who's finally like, yo, these are fucking coordinates. Like, these are coordinates in Wyoming. These are longitude numbers. So they figure out that Wyoming is kind of a ground zero for something, some kind of event. Like, this is what the ship is beaming back to them after they start playing this note out to the sky. So the ships come back. They do come back eventually. And Barry is kind of like joyfully drawn to them. Like, he's not fearful of them. But what I read about this scene is that the way that Spielberg got such strong reactions out of this 3-year-old is that off screen, he was dressed like he had people dressed as clowns and he had people playing with toys. And so his reactions are really pure when he's like, ice cream and, you know, toys. And like, because that's what Spielberg was doing off screen. And then to get the kind of jump scare, scary reactions for him, he had people jump out in like gorilla suits and jump out like as clowns and shit. So maybe scarring for life, but what a performance. What a performance. Don't think it would be sanctioned today, but what a performance from this kid who's just like this pure little sweet face and really seems to, like, he's not afraid of these, of the ship or these beings. So there's this crucial scene. It's been parodied. It's so well known. Even if you haven't seen the movie, I guarantee you've seen a part of this scene where he opens the door and it's just this red light all outside, like he's just kind of just this silhouette bathed in this red light. And his mom gets up and snatches him. And then they're inside and the aliens are like, oh, ma'am, we are coming in. And they start like, they're like, we will send a vacuum after you. We will unscrew this fucking vent. Like, there's something, we're going to come down through the fucking chimney. Like, she is trying to fight them from getting in. And she's constantly running around and like, you know, plugging the holes of her house, so to speak, so that they can't get in. And Barry, sweet as he is, just crawls out through the doggy door. And she's like, I'm sorry, did you not see me running around trying to keep these fucking things out? And this is, again, an iconic scene because he's crawling through the door and she's holding on to him and they just snatch him.
Yeah.
Something just snatches it.
I mean, we talked about this at the beginning of this episode about homes. Like, I would never have a doggy door in my house, obviously, because it's locked up pretty tight. But there's been so many movies where the doggy door plays into the plot in a very not good way. Like,
oh, yeah.
Home Alone, the fucking robbers were coming through the doggy door. Kevin had to shoot that one guy in the face. This kid gets abducted through the doggy door. I don't know. I'm just saying. Why do people still have those things?
Yeah, movies have been telling us for years, this is not a good idea. Now, counterpoint, windows.
Counterpoint, windows.
But a doggy door just seems like an invitation to come in. Like, there's a fucking hole in my house that is unmanned at all hours that my dog uses. So there's not alarmed at all. Like, just come on in. And I know you can get
a simple rubber flap that is
protecting
your child from alien abduction. That is,
I mean, been telling us for years, y'all, get rid of those doggy doors. So he's gone. Barry's fucking gone. And mom's like freaking out. She's like, what the fuck? Like, I was cool with the sunburn. I was cool with the mud, like, sculpture. I am not cool with my child being snatched.
Oh, my God.
So she fucking panics. And then we kind of go back to Roy, who is, again, in another iconic scene. We're seeing his obsession build. And he's at dinner, sitting down at dinner with his family one night, and he takes the mashed potato bowl and just starts loading them on his plate, and he starts sculpting this thing. And what's to me so memorable about this scene and so impactful about this scene is that you just see, you're kind of focused on Roy, but then right in the background is his son. And his son just silently starts crying. Like tears are just streaming down his face because he's like, something is absolutely wrong. We don't know what it is, but like he's kind of watching his dad go a little bit insane.
Yeah. And that was just so emotional.
It hits so hard. Oh, so hard. I think it was Toby, who was Justin Dreyfuss, who's his actual son, in that scene, but it just really hit very, very hard. And post that scene, we see the government again is like, so we know something's going to happen in Wyoming. Why don't we create a fake train accident gas leak so we can go to this Devil's Tower at Wyoming and figure out what's going to happen here. So as it turns out, what they've been sculpting, and, you know, Roy gets to a point where he's truly obsessed and he sculpts the whole thing in his basement by chucking trees into his house and demolishing the garden. He like goes out one morning and is like, fences, trees, shrubs, flowers, everything, mud, dirt, like let's get it into the house through the windows.
I have to say, this part cracks me up because, you know, he's got this like nosy neighbor lady that's like blow drying her hair outside of a window. I'm like, what a weird vibe. I don't know why you're doing that. Just put the blow dryer down and look out the window. Why are you doing it as you're poking your head out? Okay. But then you realize, because he takes up her like kind of chicken wire fencing, and you realize that she's put that shit out there because she's got like a duck pond.
She's got
and it just
ducks.
Looks so terrible. Like, this duck pond looks like shit, lady. Like, you put this, like, rinky-dink Home Depot fucking fake fence around these ducks. And I'm like, if I was somebody's neighbor and they had that, like, shitty-ass little pond, I'd be like, yo, do a better job. This is terrible looking.
Also, you know that shit was bad because those ducks were cruising. They couldn't wait to get away from that shit. They were fucking gone. She's trying to chase
them. We're free, bitch. Run.
We're going to a real pond. Bye. Not this ring. She had them like packed the fuck in there like sardines. And he's looking at her like, oh, I'm the weirdo. Look what you've been doing this whole time. But oh, it is truly, again, a super memorable, iconic scene. And I think it was amped up in that way to kind of ramp up his psychosis a little bit and ramp up his obsession, because that is now the point in the movie where his family leaves and he can just give himself fully over to his obsession and his passion. And it's so strange. But because of the government saying, hey, we're going to put this fake train crash on the news, he finally sees the thing that he's been sculpting. He sees Devil's Tower in Wyoming, which was the first national park in the U.S. Seems like a real cool place to go. I think they do still have people do like alien festivals and shit there. Like, but it's a really incredible place to set the end of this film. Because it is visually stunning, but then it also gives you all the space you need. So that's what happens. He takes off for fucking Devil's Tower, Wyoming, meets up with Jillian, figures out there are 12 other people there that have been kind of called to come here by this ship. They've had the same passion, the same kind of obsession driving them. They're there and they don't know why. And they get kind of tackled by the military, like, you can't come in. We don't want you here. And then three of them escape. So it's Roy, this guy named Larry, and Jillian. And they start climbing the fucking mountain. And like, we're going to figure out what's on the other side of this. Larry gets crop dusted with some fucking sleep dust. And he misses the whole thing. Like, Larry misses the whole show. He's like, good night.
I'm glad they explained that away, by the way, because there's like those scenes where, you know, they've obviously faked this like disaster. But you see these animals on the side of the road that are like, you thought they were dead. I'm like, yo, these animals are dead. But I'm so glad they came back around and said, actually, we just put them shits to sleep.
Yeah, because just for 6 hours, they wake up with a headache.
Just 6 hours, and they wake up and they have a headache, and these llamas don't know any different. Much like this man who is going to be in the ground on the side of a mountain. So both, he'll be fine.
Both the alpacas and Larry will be fine. And look, they're not going up there looking for Larry. They're like, he will come down when he's awake. Like, we're going to let
his headache will guide him home, I bet.
He might be bitten up by snakes or whatever's happening in Wyoming, but we're going to let him sleep this off. We might find him with half a face, but that's the price you pay for escaping from our helicopter. And what's incredible is that, like, Jillian and Roy make it to the other side, and they see this huge setup where it's like they've got lights and landing strips, and it's like a total scientific, like, landscape has happened. Like, they set up this whole outdoor lab, essentially, for these.
That looks like the damn Super Bowl down there.
Yeah.
I was like, what in the world is all this?
Rihanna came out, and she's like, I'm pregnant. Beep, beep, beep.
Play some tunes for my baby.
They had the left shark down there. Prince came back to life. It was like, beep, beep, beep. It looks like the fucking Super Bowl. And they start playing this goddamn five notes, and they're like signaling basically to the ships, like, it's cool, you can come out and play with us. And the three little ships come back, and they're like, all right, thanks. And then... they're like, that was great, guys. High five. And then the real show starts. Like, as they're leaving, triple the amount of ships come down. These little ships come down and start playing. They're playing the notes and they're going back and forth. And then the fucking mother load comes down. And I'm not going to ruin the entire end of the movie, but I will say, because in order to talk about my feelings from this movie, the big ship comes down. And they're trying to play the notes, and the ship finally gets it, and they're starting to communicate. And when the ship finally hits those last two notes and the windows blow out and, like, it is explosive, it gives me fucking chills. I fucking love it. But also, the ship starts kind of communicating through sound, and it's like this tonal language that they've developed. But then the fucking doors open, and that fucking hatch opens, and people start coming out, and it's all these pilots from World War II. Like, they found these planes that looked brand new, and now they find this pilots who haven't aged, and Barry comes running out of that ship, and he's so happy to see his mom, and he's like, oh, they have to go away now? She's like, yeah, and he says the cutest goodbye. He's like, goodbye. Like, he had a fucking blast on that ship. And again, I'm not going to ruin the very end, because more happens after that, but there is some shit that goes down that brings me to fucking tears. I don't know how to explain it. It just makes me, like, there's like a big old spider looking alien. It should be scary. It makes me really emotional.
Well, and I think I read that Carlo Rambaldi, the guy that did The Creature from Possession.
Yes.
He did the
effects.
Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's like, it's just an incredible, to me, it's an incredible fucking movie. It is perfect for any day. But especially when you just want to chill out and be told a good story, it's beautiful. I think it's a beautiful movie. It absolutely holds up. It is probably my favorite Spielberg movie. And I also love that at some point during the the ship's trying to communicate, he starts to play the theme from Jaws.
Yes! What a little Easter egg.
A little nod in there. But yeah, I just find it to be fucking fascinating and wonderful. And I love this movie. It's a perfect sick day movie. Anytime I'm feeling down, anytime I'm feeling like I just want to connect to a good story, this is a great movie to watch.
Well, and like, honestly, when I turned it on and watched it, first time watch, like I said, I was like, oh, of course. This is such a, like, to me, this seems like such a comfort film for people of a certain age, especially. Like, I had that moment where, you know, when you see something that is so a part of our popular culture, mm-hmm. and it's just, but you just, for some reason, haven't seen it. And then when you finally do, you just, like, connect the dots for the last 45 years of, like, oh my God, like,
yep.
This is how the shot of the guys putting the sunglasses on and stuff. I mean, that, you know, has been parodied so often, but also just like, it really made me remember how fondly people of our age group think of Spielberg. Like, I was like, oh, of course, like, this is kind of like the prototype for like all these other movies that, you know, obviously E.T., but just all these other movies that he would create like in his career, which were very like fantastical things happening, but there's also like these human elements to them, like families and kids and like, and the pacing of it, I think, is because something I will say about science fiction, and I don't want to like generalize too much, but like, you know, a lot of the science fiction that I've seen in my life is very tense and it's very like, you know, in that very X-Files kind of way where it's like, everyone's talking like this and we have to figure this mystery out. I feel like this movie breathes a lot. Like there's a lot of, like the first like two thirds of the film is essentially like family drama. Like it's basically like Richard Dreyfuss's kids and the families and like, you know, when he's outside going buck with the chicken wire and the ducks and all the families are coming out. Like it's just that thing where it's like, oh yeah, this is like the human side of this like spectacular story that's happening, right?
Yes.
And I feel like that's a Spielberg thing.
Absolutely. Yeah, it really is. And it really is, again, because it's an earlier take, it's in one of his earlier films, I think you're starting to see the artistry that he has for bringing those stories to life and his own connection to wanting to tell family stories and human stories that would bring him to something like the Fablemans now, like through all of the Schindler's List and all of the things that he's done. It's like he's really great at creating suspense and creating drama in a way that doesn't feel saccharine. It doesn't feel like he's reaching too hard or too far. Like, I believe the families that he presents in these films, and he clearly has always had something to say about the family structure and how it impacts, you know, our development and how it impacts our ability to imagine. So,
right. Yeah. No, definitely. Well, honestly, like I'm so happy again that you brought a movie to the podcast that I hadn't seen before, and it was a real treat for me to have finally seen it. Like I said, I felt like such a big gap for me, and I just got to fill it, and it was wonderful. And when it comes to a bacchiotomy, I was like, oh yeah, this is definitely what you need for a bacchiotomy. I mean, come
absolutely. You need to sit down and watch some ships and watch someone having a nightmare fever dream of his whole life.
And he gets to see Francois Truffaut act.
Exactly.
Which is always a pleasure because he's normally a director. So there you go.
Exactly. I love it. And I watched this as a true double feature, and it was really nice. It was a whole day where I did nothing but like knit and watch these movies.
Well, we do hope that you guys will watch these sometimes as double features. And hey, if you got something going on with your body or your brain and you need a little break, sit on the couch, watch these two. I feel like it's a good pairing. And I think that's all for this episode, right?
Yeah.
I mean, listen, if you want to email us, by all means, we're at isawwhatyoudidpod@gmail.com. Please send us questions for bonus episodes. They're on the main feed now, so you'll be featured if we pick you.
And you can find us on our socials at isawpod on Instagram and Twitter.
Absolutely. And we've got merch. Go to the I Saw What You Did section of the Exactly Right Shop to find our hoodie and things.
And our movies next week are pretty great.
Oh, my God.
Do you want to tell them?
Yeah, of course I do. Our movies for next week are An American Crime from 2007 and Times Square from 1980.
So good. And I will also say that An American Crime stars Elliot Page. And the if you see the photo that I'm going to post for next week on our Instagram, on our socials, the movie poster still says they're former name. So we're not doing that intentionally. We do recognize Elliot Page as Elliot Page.
Good to know.
Watch those films. He's such a great actor. I can't wait till you have you seen my movie before?
Absolutely not. So woo! 2007. Come on, B. You know my life.
Woohoo! Oh, it's gonna be good. It's gonna be good.
I'm excited. Right. Well, Danielle, as always, a fucking pleasure to do this podcast with you.
I love it. I love it so much. Thank you.
I need a bacchiotomy right now. Bye.
This has been an Exactly Right production, produced by Casey O'Brien, mixed by Edson Choi. Our theme song is by Tom Breifogel, artwork by Garrett Ross. Our executive producers are Georgia Hardstark, Karen Kilgariff, and Danielle Kramer, You can follow us on Instagram and Twitter at iSawPod, and you can email us at isawwhatyoudidpod@gmail.com. Follow I Saw What You Did on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen so you don't miss an episode.
And if you like what you hear, rate and review the show.
And visit exactlyrightstore.com to purchase I Saw What You Did merch.